All right, everybody, welcome back. Another episode of the Balanced Blues Brothers podcast. Today it's going to be myself, Travis, joined by the Score again. And we're here to actually talk about a very interesting, exciting, you know, robust time in the club. So this is our part two of our Chelsea history series from a fan perspective. And, you know, we previous part, we started with the 80s, a very, you know, turbid, chaotic, up and down time that had some formative periods with like John Neal and then some declines later on and just sort of up and down trying to save the bridge. A lot that was going on in that time. We flipped the page from the 89-90 season and Chelsea got promoted back into the first division by returning in 89-90, and they continued to play well from that promotion the 89-90 season continued on from there. But it wasn't all, you know, just roses the entire time. There was still a lot of up and downs, right, throughout the 90s, even though, you know, for the first season of, finishing in 11th in the first division, knocked out of both cups by lower league opposition, right, in the early part of the 90s. You know, we had just, a lot going on in that time. You know, we got some huge players. We were just talking before we recorded about Glenn Hoddle. We talked a lot about Ruud Gullit. Of course, we're going to get to Zola. There's a lot of formative people that, you know, as far as a club that doesn't have history, so to speak, from a lot of rival fans' perspectives, there is a lot of history in this time as far as I would suggest, even as someone who was, you know, basically, you know, born in diapers for most of what we're going to talk about today, didn't really have any interactions with the club at that time. Luckily, you were here to, you know, talk a score about what this period was like. But even as myself, just understanding and reading and kind of getting the history from what I've been able to surmise from other people's thoughts on it, is that this period was really what laid a lot of the foundations for what eventually happened in the 2000s. And we're actually really looking forward to that. It's going to be a very interesting episode when we get to that one. Going to have one of our old original hosts hopefully back on for that too. So we'll start. Just kind of getting into it. Let's talk about, you know, we get back in the 89-90 season, we get promoted back to the first division and the club really goes from there, starting 90-91. How did the 90s start for you as a fan? And what was your kind of perspective on that? And how did the 90s go from basically exiting such a difficult, turbulent, up and down, who knows what the future is, 80s, turning the page to the 90s? And it's just, although there were ups and downs on, you know, a decade long trend, it was a lot of up, right? A lot of upward growth quickly and landing players of huge international stature, right? A lot of fame around some of the people we brought in. How did the club turn the scale so quickly? And what did it feel like as a fan, you know, turning the page from the 80s to the 90s?
Well, the start of the 90s it was the same old Chelsea, really. We were, you know, mid-table. We occasionally fought relegation. Didn't compete for trophies. Always got knocked out by lower league opposition. We got giant killed all the time. And we were kind of just treading water at that point. Bobby Campbell got us promoted. I think he got promoted in it. I think we got promoted in 89, I think that's the reason we got promoted. And then he stayed, I think, another year, 18 months. And then Ian Porterfield took over for a while. Not my favourite Chelsea manager, I'll be honest. We actually made some big signings at the beginning of the 90s. We signed Dennis Wise, who ended up, you know, being a proper Chelsea legend and captain. And we signed Andy Townsend, who was a really good midfielder, box-to-box midfielder, kind of really dynamic. Northern Ireland international, really good player, who actually ended up leaving us to go to Aston Villa because they were a bigger club than us at that point. And we signed a centre back called Paul Elliott, who was a really, really top class centre back. He was, you know, he was on the verge of becoming an England international. He would have been one of the best centre backs in England. But he got injured. He got a really bad injury against Liverpool, I think it was. An injury that now you probably would recover from and come back to play, but back then was not an injury that you could come back from. So he had to retire. And that was unfortunate because he was a really top centre back that we had in the early 90s that would have probably been part of the team for the rest of the decade if he'd stayed, you know, if he'd not got injured. So there were kind of some, like, again, it was like a lot of investment and expectations briefly raised at the beginning of the 90s, but nothing really happened. And I think like Chelsea fans were just at this point like, well, it's 20 years now, we haven't won a trophy, haven't even been in a final for 20 years. So like growing up with that, it was kind of like, I was just used to it. I didn't really have any expectations because I'd never seen us win anything. I'd never seen us get to a final. So I just like going to the game just for the enjoyment of going to games, really, like standing in the shed with my dad and stuff, you know, and that was it. But the important thing that happened in the beginning of the 90s was the Premier League. That was when the Premier League started. 1992, I think. 1992, 93 was the first season of the Premier League. And big money was coming into the game. And I think what happened is that Ken Bates and Colin Hutchinson, who was the chief executive, like they, yeah, that's right, it was 1993, the first season of the Premier League. They realised that this was, you know, the opportunity was, we had to do, so if we were ambitious at all, we had to just start doing something about it. And we couldn't financially compete with people like Manchester United or Liverpool at that point. We weren't a rich club. We'd at that point, I think we'd won the battle of over the ground. That was kind of over, but we weren't a rich club. You know, we couldn't spend big money at that point. And so, you know, we had to kind of build something. And that's why they turned to Glenn Hoddle. Because Glenn Hoddle had been done a really good job as a manager at Swindon. You know, I mean, it's a very small club, Swindon, but he had got them playing really good football. Tactically, they were really good. They got promoted to the Premier League via the playoffs. You know, he did a really, really good job, looked a really promising young manager. And of course, it was Glenn Hoddle who had trained at Chelsea when he was injured, I think, at one point in the early 90s. So he already had the kind of link with him. But he was a Spurs legend. I think that's important to note. But he was a big name. He was a massive name in football. Like, so, yeah, he was the kind of guy that could attract players and did eventually attract players because of his name. So appointing him was going to be a big statement. And yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Like that we've just appointed a former Spurs legend, really, as a manager, even though he won nothing. That tells you about Spurs. But yeah, it was the same. Like Glenn Hoddle had won things at Spurs. He'd been one of the best players of his generation, basically, like, you know, world-class player. And he'd gone to Monaco and won things and worked with Arsene Wenger, who he learned a lot from in terms of coaching, wanted to play football the right way, which wasn't fashionable at the time at all. So, yeah, I think Ken Bates went for him and got a kind of provisional agreement before the playoff final. It was kind of almost a done deal before then. Spurs did actually come in for him at the last minute, but he said no because he'd given his word to Chelsea, which says a lot about him, I think, actually. Like, because he could easily have just gone to Spurs. Nobody would have blamed him because that was his club. But he didn't. He chose Chelsea and stuck with that. And so he came, and that was a really big... Suddenly there was a load of attention on Chelsea that hadn't been before. because it was Glenn Hoddle. But if people have read the book about the Battle of Stamford Bridge and seen a documentary about it as well, they'll know this. But it was, he came to Chelsea expecting to find like big club facilities and like higher standard of training ground and all of that. And what he found was the complete opposite. I mean, Chelsea's training ground was basically a school playing field near Heathrow Airport, with the line of the all the planes landing came over the top of the ground, the playing ground. So it was really loud. And Wednesday afternoons, we weren't allowed to train because the school came to do their PE classes or whatever. There was no canteen, there was no showers, and the telephone was basically a payphone, like which had the bottom opened up with the coins all there. You just put them through. And Glenn Hoddle told a story about when he rang Ron Atkinson to buy, I think, to buy a player, and that he could hear the pips on the phone because when you put the money in, and he had to try and explain it away. But that was Chelsea Football Club back then. It was, that was it.
I mean, the
And
club was not that many years prior to what you're describing. I mean, we were facing some serious, serious financial, trouble for our future, like a very uncertain will we survive future. So, I mean, yeah, it's pretty impressive to operate on such a lower amount of, money and facilities that yet still were able to have such a, I don't want to say explosive growth, but continual growth and getting these really high quality players and managers to come to us despite those facts, because I'm sure as a player I would factor in like my working quality, the quality of my working conditions day to day in any decision I make.
And there's an interesting story about that as well, which I suppose we'll get to Ruud Gullit in a minute. But when he signed Ruud Gullit, he deliberately avoided taking him to the training ground and to the stadium because he didn't want him to see them. He wanted to get him signed before he could see any of that. So he just told him there was like building work going on, like at the ground and at the training ground stuff, so that he could. And he took him out to an Italian restaurant instead.
That's recruiting 101.
So that's a quite a funny story, actually. But that was Chelsea at the time. It was, we weren't acting like a big club at the time. I mean, that was one of the things that Glenn Hoddle did. He came in and saw all of that and said, "Right, we need to change this. We need to improve this." So he got a proper canteen in there with a he got players eating properly. He got players training properly. He managed to get us being able to train on Wednesdays in the mornings because we couldn't do it in the afternoons. He got a bit of investment in the ground. Like eventually, I think he got an office. Did he get an office? I think eventually, like or a phone. But so he just raised the standard at Chelsea immediately because obviously he'd been used to the highest echelons of football. He'd been at big clubs that had won things and with money, and so he'd got used to a certain level, and that was needed. That. Him coming in was needed because it raised that standard immediately.
It's almost like you gotta have it's like, I don't know, the analogy I'd go with here is, if you're just walking around the same halls and the same rooms and the same thing every day, it's just gonna look normal to you. But then you get that outside set of eyes that comes in and was like, no, this is not normal. This is not how what big clubs do. This is not how people with ambitions operate, right? And then they offer that continual improvement. And it's, I just think it's interesting how those small, outside perspective changes can make such a big difference in large ways, but they're small changes.
Yeah, and I mean, we'll get onto this in the next episode. But when Peter Kenyon joined Chelsea 10 years later, he came to the training ground and he was like, "How have you managed to convince all these international players to join you? Because this is rubbish." And it was like literally immediately, right? We're going to design a new training. Like this is when Abramovich came in. It was like, right, we're getting a new training ground as soon as possible, and like we're going to just spend whatever it takes basically to. And that's how Cobham started, So that was like, yeah, that was because Penny Ken, you couldn't believe we'd sign people like Hernan Crespo and stuff with that training ground. And there was no club doctor at that, like even in 2003. Like, yeah, I know. It was just but anyway, we'll get onto that in the next episode. But I mean, you think that's 2003? This is 10 years before that. So It was potentially even worse. But, it did kind of lift the profile of the club, and he made some decent signings. Gavin Peacock, in particular, attacking midfielder, was really, I thought, was a good signing from Newcastle. And he did well for us. He scored a lot of goals for us. He scored in the FA Cup semi-final. He scored in the two games against Manchester United when we beat them. I mean, that's typical Chelsea. We were the only team that beat Man United twice in the league that season, and they absolutely ran away with the league. And then we'd lose to some mid-table team like who was absolutely rubbish. So that was Chelsea back then. It was kind of a project. We were second from bottom at Christmas. And he didn't give up on his philosophy at all. He stuck with it. We signed Mark Steen up front, who came in and scored a lot of goals for us. Was basically a penalty box player. And he scored a load of goals for us, which made sure we stayed up, finished mid-table, got to the FA Cup final. So actually, it ended up being a pretty decent season in the end. Chelsea hadn't been to a cup final for like 20, 22 years.
Yeah, I mean,
At all.
we went to halftime nil nil in that cup final against, United, and
Yeah, we
we all
should have
know
won.
United in the 90s. Like, most people know how that story went, and ended up losing 4-0. But given where we were earlier in that year, basically fighting relegation, needing these signings to come in and kind of help us stave off relegation, getting the cup final was a huge moment for us.
It was because the other thing about it was that we got into Europe because Manchester United did the double. So they won the league and they won the FA Cup. So, and
Yep.
at that time, when you won the FA Cup, you got into this thing called the Cup Winners' Cup.
Basically, the UEFA, the Club World Cup before it was like all European
It was
cup winners,
basically,
right?
all the teams that won domestic cups all over Europe went into this, and it was a really good competition. It was like you often got some really good teams in it. Aberdeen won it in the early 80s, and they played Real Madrid in the final. It was a big competition. And we hadn't been in Europe, for 20 years or whatever. So that was huge as well. Like we got into Europe, and that would be extra revenue as well for the club, which was good for the club. So we were able to make like a couple of signings. I think we signed Paul Furlong, striker from Coventry, for about 2.5 million, which was a big deal for Chelsea then. I can't remember all the signings that we made, but that was one that stood out. We often signed strike. We had signed a lot. We had a lot of strikers in the early 90s that kind of didn't get the 20 goals a season, but some of them did a good job.
Yeah.
One of my favorites was John Spencer. We got him from Rangers. Short guy, but wow, he was an absolute fighter. Give 100% every game. Really nimble, quick. And he scored some good goals. He was a pretty decent player, and kind of was a cult hero, really. He was kind of he didn't get 20 goals a season, but he often got 10, 12 goals in a season, in all competitions, which was about what we could get at that point. We weren't getting anyone who was getting 20 goals a season. Nobody got a hat trick for Chelsea in the 1990s, I think, until 1996, I think. Literally, we went 5 or 6 years when nobody got a hat trick for Chelsea. It was like an embarrassment, and we'll get on to when that happened in a minute. It was so that season was really good though. We got to the Cup Winners' Cup semi-final, which was like we were never expected to get that far. There was no way we were, like nobody expected us to get that far because we finished 11th in the league again.
Yeah, it was a lot of mid-table finishes for us in the early part of
Yeah.
the like the early half of the 90s. The first 4 or 5 years were a lot of middling, more of the same. We're not we still had some flirting with relegation a little bit here and there, but it was kind of just we were, sort of like a Crystal Palace-y type club at that time. If
Yeah.
you want to, for any modern day viewers that are listening, that's probably, in my opinion, a fairly good comp of what we were in the early 90s.
Yeah. I would agree. Yeah. Basically at Crystal Palace are now, yeah, absolutely. And we had some decent players, but no kind of real superstars. And we had good cup runs, didn't win it. Yeah.
Same Palace, yeah, not that long ago, the famous, they were in a FA Cup final not too long ago, and against,
And a semi-final against us last year.
yeah.
And so that's a pretty good analogy, actually. Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty much what we were at that point. We've made progress under Hoddle because we got to a cup final, we got to a European semi-final. So the profile of the club was going up,
Yeah.
and this is when Matthew Harding came in, because Ken Bates realised that he needed investment in the club to build the new stadium, because we needed to become an all-seater stadium, and also to invest in the team if we were going to be competitive. And so he asked for people to come in. He posted this advert in the newspaper. Matthew Harding saw it, and he was a lot richer than Ken Bates. So he came in and invested in the club. He paid £5 million to build what became the Matthew Harding stand, and put another £5 million in the club for players.
Which
And
back
that,
then was a lot of money.
oh yeah, that was a lot of money. That was, I mean, I can't, I'm not really good at inflation, but I can't. But I like, I mean, like Alan Shearer moved to Blackburn for 3.5 million, and that was a kind of one of the, a big a record signing. So at that point, so you can imagine. But I mean, prices started going up exponentially once the Premier League started, like
Yeah.
because Alan Shearer went for 15 million only a few years later, and that was a world record fee at the time. And the world record fee now is 198 million. So, so that's a
And that
big.
was a long time ago now. Like that was in the mid
Yeah.
2010s. Like what would the, I bet the record now, like if Mbappe goes and actually had substantial time on his contract and not a bunch of under, you know, other circumstances with that. I mean, you're talking, he's probably one of the better guys in the world right now, and he'd be going for 220, 250, somewhere in
Yeah.
there, I bet. I mean, so if people are hearing these like measly sums for today's standards, just think like back then, that's the equivalency of Neymar's move to PSG when Shearer goes for 15 million. You know, those were earth-shattering moves in terms of finances.
They were at that point. I mean, like, yeah. Chelsea's record signing at that point was 2.5 million, I think.
Which is still a lot.
Which was still, yeah, still at the time was still relatively high, but,
Yeah.
but so we'll get on, but that record did get broken in the coming, in the second half of the 90s. So we'll get on to
Absolutely.
that.
Yeah, and so kind of the, you know, I think good transition here. You know, kind of have well described how the club, you know, things were turning some ways with the way we were playing and the players we were recruiting, but there was still this element of losing to you know, basically minnows, right, in cup competitions. And then we still had this just mid-table. Every once in a while we might get in a relegation scrap, but we're going to be fine and be somewhere around that mid-table. We were just kind of perennially stuck in that sort of trend, which is not a bad place to be considering what we talked about from the 1980s. But the second half of the 90s was the was a big Italian influence on the team and really took us to a different level. And we're going to talk about that influence next.
Yeah, so then we got to 1996, 1995. This was Hoddle's third season. This was the big kind of changeover that happened. Like, they decided that with Matthew Harding now involved, they decided to invest in the team. They set out to sign Ruud Gullit, Paul Gascoigne, and Mark Hughes. They didn't, so they traveled to Italy to get Gascoigne and Gullit. Didn't get Gascoigne.
Yeah, they couldn't get Gaz, yeah.
He wanted to go to Glasgow Rangers, so that didn't happen. But Ruud Gullit did happen, and signing Ruud Gullit and his first season, I just it's so difficult to articulate for people who weren't around at the time, the seismic, the kind of the earthquake this brought to British football, like because this was a mid-table team who hadn't won anything for over 20 years, signing one of the biggest names in football. Like, this was a guy that everybody knew. Even if you weren't into football, you knew who Ruud Gullit was. He'd been World Player of the Year. He won the Euros with the Netherlands. He'd won the European Cup with AC Milan. He'd won loads of titles with AC Milan. He was a huge name, and a world-class player, and a lot of fans didn't really believe we'd signed him to start with. Like, this is before the internet as well, so you just had like newspapers and CFAX, basically, which is like a TV internet or something kind of thing where you just go on and
I remember seeing like the images of this and stuff.
It was really cool. I liked it. And every club had their own page. Like Chelsea was 324, I think. I don't know, 'cause I used to check it out every day. and when I saw him trying to do it, I was like, what? How did that happen? Like, we don't sign players like that. Like,
Is this a
how
glitch in the
is he coming
system?
to us and not going to Man United or Liverpool or someone like that? Like, but it was real, and and like Hullet mania, like really just happened at Chelsea. Like everyone wanted to go and get the shirt with his name on the back. He wore the number four shirt. The Hullet wigs were being sold. He was immediately a fan favorite without even kicking the ball, really. People just wanted to see him. Like he had his aura around him. Like, and when he got on the pitch, I mean, it was like a team of kids with an adult playing with them. Like he just was a completely different level to everybody else. He his you know the time he had on the ball, the vision, the kind of movement that he had, like he had the physicality as well to play in the Premier League. He was quite a tall guy. He had pace. He could basically play any position on outfield position and be world class in that position. He did. I mean, he started off playing a sweeper and then eventually moved into midfield. And he also, but during the game, he would move, would go around the pitch. He'd go out the wing or he'd drop into defensive midfield or he'd go into attacking. Well, and he just ran the game. And he scored some great, couldn't score many goals, but he scored some great goals. One against Manchester City, I remember, was just, I think, got goal of the month. It was a brilliant goal. Like, just beat a couple of players and just smashed it in from 25 yards or something. Incredible goal. But it was just like, we were just all in awe of him because he was this big name and he was just this world-class player. He was the best player in the Premier League that year for me. He didn't get player of the year because Cantona got it because he came back and helped Man United win the double. But I think like Hullet was the best player in the league that year. He was world class that season. And him that season gets into any Chelsea 11 ever. Like seriously, like he was, and you could play him in any position as well. He wouldn't like you could play him up front, you could play him on the wing, you could play him in midfield, you could play him in defensive midfield. Playing at centre back wouldn't matter. He was, so we couldn't quite believe it at first. And then on the day that he signed, Mark Hughes signed as well. And we were like, and this is Mark Hughes was like, had been an absolute elite, top class striker at Manchester United. He won everything. He won, apart from the European Cup, he won Premier Leagues, he won cups, he played for Barcelona. He was a top striker still. And so to get him as well was like, and he said he joined because of Ruud Gullit as well. So that was the immediate impact of Ruud Gullit joining was other people wanted to join us. It was that big of an impact.
Talent attracts talent.
Yeah, and Gullit had joined because of Glenn Hoddle, because he knew that Glenn Hoddle was going to play the right kind of football that suited him. He didn't want to play kick and rush football. He wanted to play, passing, possession, technical. Football like you
Which
play,
is
and he knew that Glenn
some,
Hoddle could do that.
and that was something we were, I don't want to say we pioneered that kind of football because that's just not correct, but what I would say is that we were, and correct me if I'm wrong, but in that period of the 90s, there weren't a ton of teams playing that way, yet we were playing that way. We
Yeah,
had this
that's true.
very visually attractive, attacking based football at the time. It wasn't, the base. We weren't the people on the frontier doing that because you could go back like the Arrigo Sacchi days and, the Cruyff days and in earlier days where the basically positional play idea started earlier. But we were one of the, if I understand correctly, we were one of the only people, not the only, but one of the fewer people in England that were trying to actively play that way, despite some of the way, the downsides that it had in that era. We were still somebody that maybe because of the way we played more neutral or like younger fans could visually be more attracted to how we play and build more familiarity with us.
Yeah, I mean, Man United play really good attacking football.
Oh, absolutely. But
for sure, they were one of the best attacking teams at the time. Like, and it was great to watch. But yeah, I know what you're saying. And like, when we signed Dan Petrescu as wing back, who was one of our best ever signings, really good player, technically brilliant, great vision, great, passing, good in possession, to play wing back in that three, I think it's 3-5-2 basically we played. And this all kind of came into, there was one game where everything just worked, right? Where Hullet was in midfield, just dominating the game, like passing it around. This was against Middlesbrough.
Oh, I was going to say this is the FA Cup final, right?
No. This is not the FA Cup final.
Okay.
This was a league game. This was a year before the Cup final, and we won. It was a Stamford Bridge, and we won 5-0. And in the second half, we played some of the best football I've ever seen. We were playing. Yeah, it was passing, movement. Everyone knew where they meant to be. It was like watching Barcelona a little bit. And it wasn't with Barcelona level players apart from Hullet, but Hullet was making it all work. His vision and his passing, his movement, and everything just the football was so fluid, and we just looked such a good side, and we scored 5 goals. We could have scored more. And Gavin Peacock got a hat trick, which is the first hat trick, the first Premier League hat trick for a Chelsea player. And this is 4 years after the Premier League started. We haven't had a hat trick for that long. I mean, it was, it got that bad with strikers. but it was incredible. But that game basically got Glenn Hoddle the England job because the football was just brilliant. And if he'd actually been able to stay and been given some really good players to work with, he would have created a really great football side at Chelsea without any question. But as I said, he got the England job. Of course, behind the scenes, it was getting a bit difficult at that point because Matthew Harding and Ken Bates were now kind of at war, and there was a tabloid war going on between them, which wasn't really great and wasn't good for the fans, really. But and you had also the Hoddle thing, getting linked with England and what's going to happen to Chelsea after he goes. How are they going to keep this model of football? So that season, the end of that season was kind of a bit, people weren't sure what was going to happen. We got to the FA Cup semi-final, though. And again, the first half, we outplayed Man United, went 1-0 up, Ruud Gullit scored. And then in the second half, we got a couple of injuries, and back then we didn't have the depth to deal with it. And Man United then took advantage of that, and we ended up losing. And they did the double again that season. but it was kind of recognised that we made a big step forward that season. Mm-hmm. The football that we were playing, the profile of the club was getting a bit higher. We're kind of ready for that next step now. Like, let's invest in a few good players and maybe we can win something and get into Europe. And at that point, when Glenn Hoddle left, there were like two choices basically for the manager's job. Ken Bates wanted, I think, well, there was a rumor that he wanted George Graham, who won league championships and cups and European Cup Winners' Cups with Arsenal, been a really good manager. He'd been a Chelsea player, George Graham. So there was a link with Chelsea from the past. But having had this football under Glenn Hoddle, Chelsea fans didn't want George Graham. And they made that very, very clear in the last game. Yeah. They told him basically where to go. And they also worried that if he'd come in, then Ruud Gullit would have left, because he wouldn't have been the right kind of football. And so, I mean, all the fans basically wanted Ruud Gullit as manager. And this is a big thing, actually, because we in the last episode, we talked about how racism was such a big part of Chelsea, especially in the early 80s.
Yep.
And now you had all the Chelsea fans cheering for probably the biggest named black player in the world and wanting him to become their manager as well. So it was a huge moment. I know there's been interviews with a lot of fans, black fans, who said that was a big thing for them, like in feeling they were welcome, they could come to Chelsea, Stamford Bridge safely.
Yeah.
That, the fans
basically
were,
10 years to go from first black player to first black manager that everybody is 100% supporting, it sounds like. And that's not sound like a big thing, you know, as far as, well, you know, maybe progress should have already been made. And I would agree with you on that. But if you were to make that argument, but you got to look at progress in incremental ways. And I think, like, that's a great example of that progress was pretty exponential for that to happen and the culture to be reversed that quickly.
Yeah. And the whole culture of football was changing as well. You know, this was, you know, post Hillsborough, post Heysel, where everyone, it was now all seater stadiums. Yeah. So hooliganism was kind of getting eradicated because of that. So the culture around football was getting better as well. And you had Euro 96, which was great for football in this country. England did well in that. That was a, Ruud Hullet was actually a pundit during that tournament, which, when he just got the Chelsea job, which was really interesting for Chelsea fans, like, because he had really good analysis. He clearly knew what he was talking about, nearly clearly knew what he was doing tactically. He worked under Sacchi, you've got to remember. So he probably learned a lot from him. And the other thing about Hullet was that he attracted top players. You know, Gianluca Vialli, you know, rest in peace, absolute legend. He joined on a free transfer. And then we signed Roberto Di Matteo. That was a club record signing. I think 4.5 million or something like that. And then we signed Frank Leboeuf, like as a sweeper. Wasn't that well known, but was really, really good. Really good on the ball, good at passing, good at bringing it out from the back. You know, good defender, good leader as well, good strong character. And those guys came into the team, so there was a lot of hope around Chelsea for that season, for Hullet's first season. And we started pretty well, playing some good football, and you know, won our first few games, like defending pretty well. But then there was a tragedy. Matthew Harding, you know, tragically was killed in a helicopter crash with a few other people coming back from a game. Again, you know, rest in peace.
I mean, although he butted heads so much with Ken Bates, even as someone who's just now starting to understand the history a lot more, I'd find a hard argument to think that we would still be the same club have Harding not gotten involved the way he was involved.
Absolutely. I agree.
Huge influence for us as a club. And I mean, I think a lot of his spending and the redevelopment, the things he focused on, the business side of everything that he did, that although it butted heads with, you know, Bates many times, sometimes, you know, you can butt heads with people, but it's all for the productive struggle, right? We're all trying to get to a better goal from this. And I think he did that super well. And I mean, that's why we literally have a stand named after the guy. Not only did he fund it, but he had a big, it's not that he just threw money, it's that he left a legacy at the club. And so I understand was basically just a fan of the club that was able to, you know, just basically a fan of the club.
Yeah. There was no doubt. And fans recognized that, you know, when he died, and that he, you know, that he'd been hugely influential in turning us into what we were becoming.
Yeah.
And so, and we got an immediate kind of boost after his death because we signed Gianfranco Zola. Now, yep. Gianfranco Zola is the guy that made me fall in love with football.
And did we already have Vialli when we signed Zola, or was he?
Yeah, we did. Yeah, we yep. did. Yeah.
Another hugely important character for us.
Yeah, he changed the dimension of the team. He was a magic player. He could do things with the ball that I couldn't even comprehend until then. And he was a lovely guy, really good professional, really good attitude. Just changed the team. Like, it was, you know, he was, and again, he won Player of the Year, the Premier League Player of the Football of the Year that year. And he joined in November. So that tells you the impact that he had. You know, this guy was, I remember that one of his early games, he played up front with Mark Hughes, and he beat, like, in the first 10 minutes, he beat like two or three players, left one defender like lying in wake on the floor, and scored. Like, this was against West Ham. People will know that goal if you just go and look at, so just Google Zola West Ham goal, and then you'll see it. It was an amazing goal. We won the game 3-1, and him and Mark Hughes struck up this great partnership up top, which saw us through that season. And Vialli kind of got relegated to the bench a bit. which was amazing considering, you know, when we signed him. But the fans still cheered for him. The fans still loved him. He was a real pro, didn't complain. And the fans respected that as well. And then, of course, this, we come to the FA Cup, which is we got into the fourth round. We played Liverpool at home. And this was a big game in Chelsea's history. Like, we went 2-0 down after 20 minutes. We were getting absolutely battered. And we thought, oh, this is it for another year. We're not going to win a trophy this year either. At half time, Rüdiger brings on Mark Hughes. So you've got a front three of Hughes, Zola, and Viali in that game. And second half, we destroyed them. We just destroyed them. Mark Hughes scored a goal. Then Zola hit a brilliant curler, like unbelievable goal. Viali then got a couple of goals, and they just didn't know how to defend against us. We just outdid them completely in that second half. And they were basically chasing shadows. And yeah, we won that game, and it was such an energy shift at that moment. Everyone felt like we're going to win the FA Cup, aren't we? Like, after that game, and it was only the fourth round, but it was like we almost felt like our name was on it from that moment. And so obviously, you know, we got all the way through to the final, played Middlesbrough in the final. We were the favorites this time. It was very different from 94. Like, we were happy to be there in 94, and then this time we kind of, you know, we were the favorites, and we acted like it, to be honest. And within, like, we were 1-0 up in 43 seconds. Di Matteo scored
The
this
famous Di
great run.
Matteo goal.
Yeah, and the defense almost opened up in front of him, and he just smacked this shot from 25, 30 yards. And the guy in goal from Middlesbrough was Ben Roberts, who's currently a goalkeeping coach at Chelsea now. That's a little side note.
Ironic.
And yeah, and we won the lap. And after that, honestly, I was just like, I was strangely confident. After that, and we didn't get a second goal till the 82nd minute, and that was Eddie Newton, who was a homegrown player, kind of defensive midfield player at that point. Won the ball, then drove forward, and then ended up getting the goal from a flick back by Zola, and that was it. And we won the FA Cup, and it's difficult to explain to fans who Chelsea win trophies every year now, almost it seems like. But then we hadn't won anything for 26 years. Like, I'd never seen Chelsea win a trophy. I was 20 years old. I'd never seen Chelsea win a trophy ever. So I went absolutely nuts. Like, and it was like almost like a relief, like a pressure valve had been taken off. Like we got over the hump kind of thing. Like, we won the trophy, the first trophy. Like, and after that, that was really the catalyst for everything that came after. You know, Chelsea then started winning things again, and you know, then went into the next season. We made a few good signings: Tor-André Flo, Gus Poyet, Ed Dehoy, and a few other players. We made some really good signings, again for not too much money, to be honest. And you know, we kind of set out again to kind of take the next step. Graham Lissou signed as well, left the England left back for 5 million. So that was our record signing then, and we started really well. You know, we were scoring loads of goals. We were playing great football. It was really great to watch. It was really fluid. We beat Spurs 6-1, beat Barnsley 6-0. We beat Southampton 4-2. Now, we were scoring so many goals, and we were conceding a few as well, unfortunately, but we were scoring a lot of goals.
Hey, you only got to score one more than the opponent. That's it.
So it was great to watch. We were like second in the Premier League in November, I think. After that Spurs
Wow.
win, we were second in the league, and I think we won the most games at that point of any team. So we were doing really well, but
Absolutely.
there was this thing in the background of Rüdiger's contract,
Yep.
because he was contracted as a player manager, and he wasn't really playing now. You know, he'd been focused on the coaching. He'd been focused on other things. He hadn't really been keeping fit, so when he did
Things.
play, he wasn't great. He wasn't anything like he'd been when in that first season. It was like chalk and cheese, you know. He had like that. It's like Ivanovic drop off that we had one
Yeah,
year.
oh man,
It was like that. It was
that
kind of
was
like
the
that. Yeah, he
dude's
wasn't.
legs literally fell off in 3 months.
Basically, that's basically what happened. And he wanted to continue as a player manager because he wanted to get paid more money. Chelsea was saying, like, no, we don't want you to be as a player anymore. We want you to be just as a manager, and we're going to pay you just as a manager. They were still offering a salary that was going to be like the best in the league, like, which, considering he hadn't won, he only won the FA Cup, you know, he wasn't Alex Ferguson, was pretty incredible. But basically, they couldn't agree on a contract. And it got to a point where, as well, players were starting to get a bit like
Tired of the controversy surrounding and everything.
and yeah, and he's got a big ego with it, which you can understand, being World Player of the Year, right? But he was getting a bit too obsessed with his own kind of brand, and he wasn't always at training, and you know, he was
Yeah, it's.
fucking off a bit, and players didn't like that. And it basically got to a point where something had to happen, and it did out of the blue. We didn't realize this was all going on because
Exactly.
his Twitter didn't exist then, so we didn't know all this stuff was happening. And then it just kind of, he got, we lost to Arsenal in the league. We were losing in the League Cup semi-final after the first leg as well, both to Arsenal. We were doing well in the Cup Winners' Cup. We were in the quarterfinals, I think. But that was it, really. He got sacked and immediately got replaced by Gianluca Vialli. And
Go from one player manager to the next.
yeah, I mean, yeah, and but he was really the only guy that could have succeeded Philip, because Philip was still popular with the fans at that point. So it would have, it was a, wasn't an easy decision to make. But it was absolutely proven to be the right decision, because Gianluca Vialli went on to become the most successful Chelsea manager ever at that point. Obviously, since then, we've had managers who've done more than him, like Mourinho, for example. But at that, like, by the time he left, he'd been, he was Chelsea's most successful manager in terms of trophies. So it did turn into the right appointment. And the first game, it's quite a legendary story that he gave everyone champagne, all the players, before kickoff, and said, right, just like, let's remember the good things of the past and what we did together. And now we're starting on a new adventure together, and let's go and, like, you know, be together, be a team, you know. So they had a glass of champagne just before kickoff, and Chelsea won 3-1. You know, we got to a cup final in his first game in charge, and that was really it. Like, there was, you know, we changed the style of play a little bit, became a bit more Italian, a bit more tactical, a bit more organized, really. And you know, we ended up finishing fourth in the league that year, which wasn't Champions League at that point. Third was Champions League. But we won the League Cup, and Vialli decided to leave himself out of the squad, even though he'd been in brilliant form in the League Cup, and probably could have started. He left himself out of the squad. And you know, Di Matteo scored in the final again. And Frank Sinclair got the other goal, and it was against Middlesbrough again. As well, who had Paul Gascoigne playing for them at that point, and thanks to Gareth Southgate was playing for them as well. And so we won 2-0, we won the League Cup, and the players instructed Vialli to go and lift the trophy instead of, so normally it's the captain, who was Dennis Wise at that point, but they told Vialli to go and lift the trophy because they were all behind him. They knew the sacrifices that he'd made to you know, not to play. And he probably could have played and deserved to play, and so he got to lift the trophy, and that was a huge moment, really. That was because the whole, all of the fans were behind Vialli. Like, Vialli was a cult hero, like, almost from the time he signed. Because when he signed, he said he wanted to become a Chelsea legend on the day he signed, and he was just this, the kind of man that he was, the kind of character that he was, the kind of player that he was. He really took to the fans took to him. You know, he had charisma, he was a leader, he always worked hard, he was a great player. Yeah, he was like your typical Chelsea player, really. But now he was doing it as a manager as well.
Nice.
And so we won the League Cup, and then we got to the Cup Winners' Cup final, you know, and that was a miracle in itself, because in the quarterfinals we
Yeah.
looked like out. And then we had this great comeback at Stamford Bridge, and ended up going through, which was amazing, really. Mark Hughes got a couple of goals in that game. Really was an incredible comeback. Showed you the spirit in the team, and how much they were behind the manager as well, which was really good. But yeah, we got to the final, and then Zola didn't start the final, so that was controversial. It was 0-0. Zola came on for the last 5 minutes or so, scored with his first touch. It was unbelievable goal, just smacked it in, and he went. I've never seen Zola get so absolutely apeshit when he scored. Like he just lost it completely. Like I think he was so frustrated that he hadn't started. He just
Yep.
took all the frustration out with that shot and then with that celebration. That cemented him as a Chelsea legend. He was already a Chelsea legend, really, but that cemented it, and win the Cup Winners' Cup was huge, so three trophies in 2 seasons
That's
now.
huge for us.
We hadn't won anything in 26 years, no, won three trophies in 2 seasons. We then won the European Super Cup that's in the start of the next season against Real Madrid, which was
Yep.
again huge. We made some more signings that summer. We signed Kazaragi to replace Mark Hughes. We signed Albert Ferrer, play right back, who come from Barcelona, and Marcel Desailly, who was we got him for an absolute bargain considering how good he was, 4.5 million. And he was world class for us. Didn't win much with us, but he was a world class player without any doubt, and a leader, and a winner. He was, he come from AC Milan, where he won loads of things. So that season was brilliant. We should have won something that season. We would have won the league if Kazaragi had not got the career-ending injury that he got, because he looked really, really good for us and then got this career-ending injury, which again probably wouldn't have been a career-ending injury now, but it
Yeah.
was there. And so that kind of cost us, and we only lost the league by 4 points.
Pretty close.
Really close. So we drew so many games. We only lost three games that season in the league. So we yeah that if we if we no if we'd won if we if we if we'd won three of the games that we'd drawn that season, we would have won the league. And you think we didn't have the spending power of Man United or at that point. Arsenal would have been ahead of us as well. They won the double the previous year. They were a great side. So we came really close. We got to the FA Cup quarterfinals, knocked out by Man United. League Cup quarterfinals, we got knocked out. Cup Winners' Cup, we got to the semi-finals again. Probably should have gone through, but went out. But we played some brilliant football that year. We it was Zola scored 16 goals. He was fantastic. Flo got a lot of goals. Poyet looked really. Poyet was an excellent signing, free transfer. It was in such fun to watch that team. It was
Yep.
loved watching that team, and they made you proud to be a Chelsea fan because they had great team spirit. They worked hard. They're professional. Good mentality. Always showed up. Didn't disappear when things got difficult. You knew that. And Dennis Wise, captain of the team, you knew the team had a heart as well.
Yeah.
Because he was like you didn't mess with Dennis Wise. And that was such a great team, and we deserved to win a big trophy that season. We that was the best Chelsea team that I'd seen at that point in terms of consistency. Because, like I said, we only lost three games. We got around 70 odd points, which nowadays we could probably get you. We finished third, but we weren't far off. It was. I actually really loved that season, even though we didn't win anything, because we were so consistent, and we had such a good squad as well, in depth. Of course, it was our goal scoring that let us down, as often happens. Our defense was incredible that year. We didn't concede that many goals. We had Ed Dehoy in goal, who was fantastic. We had Leboeuf and Desailly centre back pairing, which was a great partnership. We had leaders all over the pitch. It was such a fun season that, and you can watch that. The review of the season is on YouTube of that season, if you look for it. The season review. It's a really great season. It's just such a shame we didn't win anything. And we thought after that, that okay, we're ready to go again and go for the title, but didn't happen in the next season. But we were in the Champions League for the first time ever.
Yep.
And we got to the quarterfinals. We played AC Milan away, like a legendary game, really, like the San Siro. 1-1, Dennis Wise getting that goal, because they were a really good side, you
Yeah.
know, and it was that was kind of a legendary game. That Champions League one was really exciting. Played Barcelona in the semi-finals, the quarterfinals, sorry, won at home 3-1. Lost in the second leg. It was 5-1, but that was kind of a bit of an abnormality. We could have easily got through, but we'd signed some good players that summer as well. We'd signed Didier Deschamps, who's the France captain, who just won the World Cup.
Yep.
Defensive midfield player. We signed Chris Sutton up front, which probably wasn't a good signing. Probably one of the worst signings that we've made,
Was a
actually.
bad one. Very bad one.
I don't know how many goals he got. It wasn't many, though. And I can't remember who else we signed.
Well,
Gosh.
we ended up I mean, we didn't we end the in the when it was when he joined. Okay, so he joined in the 2000s, but I was thinking we also had you know Tim Weah that joined at one point, but that was the
Oh, George
2000s.
Weah. Yeah, George
Yeah.
Weah.
Oh
Yeah.
yeah, no, his Tim is
George
his
Weah. Oh,
yeah.
yes. George Weah joined halfway through that season
Yep.
from Milan, and scored on his debut against Spurs.
Yep.
And he was a big part of the FA Cup run we had that year. We got to the FA Cup final again. He scored in a few of the rounds. I was at the semi-final against Newcastle, and Gus Poyet got a couple of goals in that final. That was when Bobby Robson was at Newcastle. So they were a difficult team to play against, you know. But we'd all thought we were going to win the league that year, and we didn't. And it was sad. We beat Man United 5-0 at Stamford Bridge. We scored, like, literally, I think it was after 29 seconds, something like that. Like, it was almost from kickoff, I think. And we ended up winning 5-0, absolutely battering them. And this is a team that were absolutely running away with the league. You know, I mean, after that game, everyone thought Chelsea were going to win the league, and, you know, because it was November, but we didn't. But it was still a great game. Poyet got two goals. Chris Sutton got his, I think it's his only Premier League goal for us in that game. Jody Morris scored in that game. He was an important part of this team, homegrown player. John Terry was already coming into the squad as well. He'd been kind of a squad player. He started off in midfield, and he was in the squad at that point. You know, he wasn't starting regularly, but he was in the squad at that point. So the kind of a beginning of the next era was already kind of coming. I think Carlo Cudicini had already joined as well, I think. But he was our backup goalkeeper at that point. So that was kind of the kind of 99-2000 was the last, was the end of the decade, but it was kind of really the last proper season of that team.
Yeah.
It was like the last year we were able to compete. And we won the FA Cup, which was really great. Again, another trophy. I mean, we've now won two FA Cups, the League Cup, Cup Winners' Cup, and a Super Cup in the space of like four calendar seasons, like from winning nothing, you know,
Yeah.
for and so it was, you know, Chelsea were back. We were back as a big team. And, you know, we got our pride back. We've got a manager we all loved in Vialli, although he didn't last much longer after that season.
Exactly, yeah. And we'll get to
But it
that in the
was,
next episode.
well, yeah, and it, but it was a great era. And I that was probably the most fun I've had as a Chelsea fan, because the expectations weren't ridiculously high like they are now. And there wasn't
Yeah.
like this entitlement around that there is now. We were just there to enjoy it, and we enjoyed watching this team, and we knew we weren't the favourites for
One
like the
along the
big
way as well.
trophy. But we had some great games of football. We beat some big teams, like, you know, Barcelona, Man United. You know, we beat some big teams. We drew with AC Milan. Like, we won most of the trophies we competed in, apart from the league. And, you know, it was a really good team to watch, an enjoyable team to watch, and a team with character and, you know, spirit, and who represented the shirt well. And we kind of had our pride back at this point now. It was, you know, but that was kind of those kind of 4 or 5 years coming off the back of what Glenn Hoddle built, the foundations that he built, was just a really great time to be a Chelsea fan. And, you know, and then, you know, this kind of, then you go into a transition period after this, but we'll talk about that next time. into a period that actually became even more successful, but none of us could know that at the time.
It's been, you know, as we wrap up here at the 90s, I mean, it's very evident, you know, going through everything Score just said, that the club was in a really bad time in the 80s. And then we end the 90s. I mean, we're, and 20 years is a long time, but in terms of institutions and things like that as a football club, it's maybe not as long of a time as it may seem, but have really, really turned the corner now as a club. We have a clear identity. We play, you know, attacking, attractive football. We're starting to get some of the world's biggest players. We're having player managers. And we're really revolutionizing the club for what's about to happen next as Viali took us into the 2000s. And we're going to be getting to that soon. And for listeners out there, we are trying to work on getting Kamal. You probably know him on Twitter as Lump of CFC. We're trying to get him on for this second or this third part of the episode in the 2000s. May even do two parts in the 2000s. We'll see how long it goes. But excited to continue this. It's very evident that this club is not just one that's always had the way that things are today for in 2023. And yeah, it's been a really good conversation. I think the 90s are a time I wish I would have been able to watch a lot more of, just from a lot of different perspectives of players, playing style, you know, the lack of this consistent winning expectation, yet still winning somehow. A lot of things that appealed to me then. But thanks so much for coming on. It was a great episode again. Looking forward to the next few parts of this. And I think these have been some very, very interesting, you know, things even for me to learn as a fan. And I hope it is for all the listeners out there. But until next time, keep the blue flag flying high.